CreeperCast, episode 96, 4 weeks of Halloween, part 2. Today we'll be talking about Halloween 4, The Return of Michael Myers, and Halloween 5, The Revenge of Michael Myers. We'll also have some news, some TV, and Captain Creeper's Book Corner. All that and more on this episode of The CreeperCast.
Hi, this is Rhiannon Frater. I'm the author of the As the World Dies trilogy, and you are listening to the CreeperCast.
Hello, and welcome back to another episode of the CreeperCast. I'm Jason, and with me always is Jeff and Mike. No snarky quips to send to them. I just want to thank you guys for joining me today. So sit back, relax, enjoy, get yourself a cup of coffee. I just cannot do that NPR stuff.
I was just beginning, I was getting worried. I was like, that's actually scarier than you actually having insults.
I really was. I wanted to try doing the NPR intro, and I just can't do it. So coming up on this episode, we are talking about Halloween 4 and Halloween 5. These take place, Halloween 4 takes place 7 years after Halloween 2 was made, and Halloween 5 takes place a year later. But because of the storyline of Halloween, since Halloween 2 took place the same night of Halloween 1 in 1978, they're saying it's 10 years later. What I can say about this is, you know, take everything that happened in Halloween 2. Michael Myers went into a coma at the end of that. Somehow Sam Loomis didn't, even though he's the one that didn't have the superpowers. And then Michael Myers decides to wake back up. Here's the trailer.
10 years ago, on the night of October 31st, a small Midwestern town fell victim to an escaped killer. Under the cover of darkness, he carried out the most horrifying mass murder on record. 16 people in cold blood. Ever since that night, no one has forgotten his name. And Halloween has never been the same. Now, Michael Myers has come home. He has returned for one more night of unholy terror.
Michael!
Somebody help me!
He's here to kill that little girl and anybody who gets in his way.
Oh, God!
Who's gonna be next? Ah!
Halloween 4, The Return of Michael Myers.
Maybe nobody knows how to stop him.
I love that music.
There is nothing better than that music.
So, Halloween 4. This came out in 1988. With the exception of Mustafa, who is the executive producer of the first two, it's a completely different everything, including Michael's mask. Did you notice that? They almost went with the we're just going to grab it off the rack at the Halloween shop kind of mask.
Honestly, that's kind of what I was... It looks like instead of the mask that they use for, I'm assuming, the first two movies... It was kind of like with this movie, because we all know the story. It's a William Shatner mask painted white and eye holes cut bigger, whatever. This was like they were grabbing the mask that they made of the mask or something, you know.
Yeah, exactly. It's basically what you would see every kid on Trick or Treat. And they did, and they actually played off of that.
Right.
In the movie, the fact that Michael Myers' mask has now become a Halloween commodity.
Yes. A commodity.
a commodity. Well, I mean, it's become a Halloween icon, and especially for trick-or-treaters. And that's what they were kind of playing off of when they had, you know, the scene with all the guys popping up in Michael Myers' mask.
Now, my problem with that is, you know, you get the impression from, you know, the new sheriff and whatever that they, you know, they don't talk about Halloween. They don't talk about what happened because it was such a tragic event. And yet somebody's profiting off it by selling these masks.
Yeah.
Really only, you know, if you think about it, there was only a few people who actually saw him with the mask on that didn't die.
That's very true. In the first two Halloweens, besides Sam Loomis and maybe the people that came and picked Michael Myers up after, you know, he burned. And that's really it. I mean, Lori.
Right. Lori, Loomis, and that's it. Because even the guys that picked him up, you know, after the explosion, there's no way that mask survived that inferno.
No.
So, you know, here we are. Like I said, first of all, we're exploiting this, you know, the worst mass murder, serial killing, you know, according to the trailer in history. And we're doing, and, you know, we're profiting off it with a mask that no one should even know exists.
Yeah, exactly. And it, that was it. Now, the other thing that I don't know if I like or didn't like, but in the first one that this happened, and then now in this one, why are they always transporting people on rainy nights?
It's the same thing for, you know, like when we were discussing Silver Bullet, you know, a while back, you know, in any of these movies, if you know it's a werewolf or you know someone's killing on the full moon, why the hell are you going outside on the full moon?
Yeah, but it's like, I don't know. I guess I never, you know, actually worked at in a insane asylum. But I'm going to assume that it's not common practice to move the people in the middle of the night.
Yeah, that not just the rainy night, but in the middle of the night.
Right. Or the fact that they had Michael Myers when he was hooked up, he was like in the basement.
Yeah, what is this, Hannibal Lecter's, you know, cage? I mean, the guy's been in a coma for 10 years.
Right. So, yeah, that was it. And then there was, let's talk about Dr. Loomis real quick.
Okay. I liked how he, you know, survived that blazing inferno with just a couple of patches of scar tissue.
Oh, and he's got a limp.
Which came and went.
Yes, it did.
I mean, don't get me wrong. I love Donald Pleasance. I love him as Dr. Loomis. But it was like, by this point in the series, I think he's phoning it in, honestly.
But yes, and so then you have him that somehow survives. But then after everything that happened, the way that the rest of the community talks about him, they talk about him like he's a quack.
Exactly. I'm like...
So talk about a complete change from Rob Zombie's Halloween 2, which takes place,
where
you know,
some kind of a genius.
Yeah, where he becomes this genius and sells books and everything. Sam Loomis in the original becomes this, you know, this quack that everyone nobody wants to associate with.
Yeah, I mean the guy who is in charge of wherever Michael was at, you know, flat out said, you know, hopefully once his transfer takes place, you know, Loomis will just quit.
Disappear or die.
Yeah, I knew it was something pretty strongly worded. And it's,
yeah, retire, disappear, or die.
And here's the other thing. Why are they sending him back to Smith's Grove? He's been in a coma for 10 years. It took this long to process the paperwork? Sending him back to the same sanitarium that he escaped from 10 years ago.
The well, you know, it's you know, paperwork and the IRS and the government slow. That, you know.
Yeah, I guess, man.
Jeff, you're allowed to jump in at any time. You did watch the movies,
of course. But you know, like I said, the last show, Halloween is actually your guys' area on this one.
Well, I actually have another major problem. I was talking with Jen about this. Well, there's the two problems that I have rewatching these movies. We know where it's going.
Right.
Oh.
I think, you know, psychic connection to his niece, which...
Mike, can you repeat what you just said? You cut out on us.
Oh, I was just saying I have two problems with this movie. One, as the viewers who've already seen this movie, we know where it's going. You know, the connection to Samhain and the Cult of Thorn and what have you. But we're left with, if you have never seen this movie before, you're left with wondering why the hell he's going to kill his niece now.
Right. Well, then on top of that, I'll go with your second one and then I'll jump in.
The second point I had to make is, doing the math here, Laurie Strode has been dead for a couple of years because we're dealing with little 8-year-old Jamie.
Right.
I thought it was only 9 months that she was with them. That Laurie only died 9 months ago.
Well, what I'm saying is Jamie is 8 years old.
Right.
I guess the point here with the math is that if you take the timeline, the first two movies obviously are the same night. Within a year and a half, Laurie Strode, after suffering what could only be considered the most terrifying night that any woman could go through, is not only in a relationship, but she's having kids.
Yes.
I'm like, I was talking with Jen, my wife, about it. For those of the CreeperCast listeners who don't know, Jen is my wife, and I often talk about these movies with her. I said, honey, if you had just gone through this, where your best friends had been slaughtered by what amounts to an unstoppable killing machine, you go to the hospital, and he follows you there, kills everybody else. Granted, it was the most understaffed hospital in the history of hospitals.
Yeah, isn't that weird?
so you survived this. And they actually kind of touched on this in Rob Zombie's Halloween 2. We flash forward, a year or whatever, and Laurie is in therapy. Now, you would think, even in 1978, it would take a hell of a lot of therapy for her to get over this night. And yet in a year and a half, she's in a relationship, she's pregnant. And you're like, what?
Well, that's just the resilience of Jamie Lee Curtis.
Yeah. Well, then that's another one of those cases where you kind of have to throw away suspension of disbelief. And you also have to take into consideration that they're not going to spend a lot of time explaining that part of the story to you. But in reality, there is such a thing as, PTSD, the bounce back syndrome. I mean, it's easy to make up in your own mind the idea that she hooked up with somebody at the asylum and
or just hooked up with the next guy because, she realized life therapy is short and,
and he may be dead in the next 12 hours.
Right.
Right. or she might die in a car crash 2 years later. Yeah.
Well, okay. So according to this, Jamie has been with the Tates for 9 months. And I hope I'm remembering correctly, but I'm pretty sure it's only been 9 months. So we're assuming that Laurie died 9 months previous because she had no other family. Does that sound correct?
It sounds about right. Okay. I wasn't sure on
that. Sounds doable.
Okay. Yeah. So doing some other fuzzy math. In Halloween H2O, she is the head of a school. Her son is turned 17 that year. And she said that in there that, he was her only child, which, okay, maybe she's lying to him. But if she only died, and so this little girl is, 8 years old?
Yeah.
He would have been born when she was 5 years old. So that meant that he would have had 3 years with his sister.
Okay. First of all, we're jumping ahead,
I realize that.
We're jumping ahead 2 weeks in our conversations, but
I realize that, but I just want to point that out right now.
Cause all I'm going to say about this, and I won't be here for that show because I will be in Michigan, but I will have notes typed up that you guys can put on the website and share or what have you, is the fact that I felt with H2O that they basically had just, kind of like with Highlander 3, they ignored everything that came beforehand.
Yes, that's basically what it was. Basically, yeah, with that they said, okay, this happened in 1978, this is 1998. And nothing else happened in between.
Right, exactly.
All right.
Now, there was a couple other quick things that I wanted to point out, but you go ahead, because I think I feel like I've been monopolizing this whole thing.
Oh, feel free. You know, we don't. You tend not to talk much.
All I want to say is, am I the only one who, at the beginning of the movie, thought that I was watching Terminator?
Because of the hand dropping stuff?
Oh, because of, you know, taking out the mechanic dude and taking his clothes and.
Oh yeah, yeah. But you gotta get Michael.
Rob Zombie also used in his version of Halloween too.
Right. So yeah, let's. I want to explore that because in Halloween 2 in Rob Zombie's version, he talked about the psychic connection between Laurie and Michael and stuff, and now we have the psychic connection between Jamie and Michael, mm-hmm. to where Jamie is having dreams about him even though she's never met him. You know, you're seeing, and we're going to get more into this in Halloween 5, where they actually are able to communicate with each other from distances away.
And again, I guess I just felt in with 4, you know, it was like like a pre-connection, because she, you know, in 5, and I'm sure we'll talk about it more when we get to that movie. It was a literal connection that could actually, you know, she could see what Michael was doing.
Right.
In fact, she imitated it. Whereas in 4, it was, you know, she dreamt about him. So it was like kind of a burgeoning, you know, maybe it's because he, you know, had been in a coma and he, you know, conveniently wakes up. And of course, they conveniently talk about, you know, the surviving niece in front of him, you know, which, you know, spurs him to, you know, wake up and go after her. It felt like the connection was just starting in this movie, and almost like it wasn't. You don't get the full effect of the psychic connection until the following movie.
Right, right, exactly. Real quick, any other things before we, you know, give away the ending to the film?
Well, I had a couple things, and I noticed since we're watching these movies, you know, pretty much back to back at this point. And I was actually going to say something last week when we talked about, you know, 1 and 2, but it really kind of made me think about it, especially in this movie. I never really understood the purpose of Michael's posing his victims. You know, the one note that I kind of made really kind of stuck with me is, you know, after he escapes from the ambulance and he gets to the mechanic or the garage or whatever, I mean, he kills the guy.
Right.
Takes his coveralls, and that should have been it. Yet when Loomis finds him, he's wrapped up in chains. When we flash back to, Halloween 1, you know, he poses the one friend beneath Judith Meyer's headstone.
Right.
And the one girl's in the closet. And I'm like, you know, it seems like he put a lot of thought, or maybe no thought, into it. I don't know. It's just I never understood the point behind it. You know,
I always just put that. Well, first of all, the posing of God, why can't I think of her name underneath Judith's headstone? PJ Soul's character. What the hell is her name? Anyway,
yeah, I got nothing.
But anyway, putting that underneath the headstone, to me, it's him paying homage to his sister. You know, he's seeing her as his sister, Judith Myers. And then putting stuff, putting people into, you know, wrapping them up in chains, throwing them in there, putting them into closets, putting them underneath hay, all that stuff. That's just him, you know, kind of as a way of, in my opinion, hiding the bodies. He doesn't want them to be right out in the open, with the exception of Judith. Well, you know, Linda? Linda. Yes, Linda.
Yeah. Yeah. There you go.
You know, putting her out in the open. So, I mean, that to me is the reasoning behind why he does what he does as far as displaying the bodies. We don't really know from Halloween 1 what happened to Linda's boyfriend that he stabbed. Is he still hanging on the wall?
I thought we saw him when she discovered the rest of the bodies. You know, he was not where Michael had killed him, if I remember right.
Okay, I must have glossed over that then.
But that was, you know, one of the, you know, right from the start, you know, he's posing these bodies or putting them. And I guess to me, it considering he's just out to kill his sister or in this case, his niece, you know, especially like with getting back to the mechanic, you know, there was no point in it because he'd already killed everybody else there. And so the only person who's going to, well, yeah, really the only person who sees it is Loomis, you know.
It's
so there's
sending
really,
a signal. I don't know.
Well, but yeah, I guess that you could see it, take it that particular way, but, you know, he's got to know that Loomis isn't, you know, one, he's got to, he can't honestly believe that Loomis is really scared of him because Loomis is the only one who, you know, other than his family, he's got any sort of connection to. And honestly, I mean, I guess you got to go with the whole suspension of disbelief again. Michael had no way of knowing that Loomis was going to show up there.
Right.
And then the only other thing I want to say about this movie was, again, Loomis or Donald Pleasance kind of phoning it in at times. I think he's a great actor, and I think the character's great. But I think by this time he can stop telling people that Michael is pure evil. I think we got it. I think we got it by now.
Right. All right. Yes. And at the end, real quick, I want to talk about, this is one of the few times that I think I've ever seen like an angry mob.
Yeah.
Take out one of the villains.
The mob, yeah.
In any horror film totally, outside of Frankenstein.
Yeah, it turned Frankenstein there.
But outside of that, this is the first time or the only time that I can think of an angry mob being the ones that saved the day.
Well, yeah, after they kill one of their own.
Well, yeah, but still.
There's a message there, people.
And evidently in Haddonfield, Illinois, they have a lot of hillbillies and paramilitary people that like to ride on the back of trucks with big guns.
Yes, and, it was
and that's
strange.
It. I do want to say, though, that the reason that we have Halloween 4 is because Halloween 3, Season of the Witch, tanked. It was awful.
Well, it didn't work the way they intended it.
Right.
And, I don't think it was awful at all.
Really? I thought it was horrible.
My biggest problem over the years is the fact that they call it Halloween 3 and it had nothing to do with Michael Myers or whatever. It wasn't a great film. But it was by no means any worse than some of the other stuff you guys have forced me to watch over the last few months.
Well, and again, like we mentioned last time, that the intention was to end the Michael Myers saga and just start a whole new group, anthology type.
Right. Thing Every movie it. Was supposed to be some sort of Halloween horror theme, but no longer dealt with Michael.
And the problem with that is because we had two movies that dealt entirely with Michael. We all expected to see Michael again.
Right. Now, Halloween 4, though, after Mustafa Akkad, who's the one that was the executive producer of all of the Halloween franchise, after Halloween 3, he realized that everybody, when he went to screenings, walking out of the film, kept asking, where's Michael? Because that was a big draw to Halloween. And the fact that they named Halloween 3, Halloween 3, Season of the Witch, people were expecting Michael Myers. Mm-hmm. Just like, you know, you say Friday the 13th, you can't say Friday the 13th and not have Jason Voorhees.
Well, they did. They had a whole freaking TV show.
The TV show.
Yeah, but still. Anyway, so that's when he decided to revamp Michael Myers and bring him into Halloween 4. And they actually asked John Carpenter. He was approached for the film, and he turned it down. They asked Deborah Hill to write and produce the film, which she turned it down. Now, Carpenter did team up with Dennis, I'm going to butcher this name.
Etchison,
who used the pseudonym Jack Martin. Mm-hmm. And had and so they, you know, kind of helped co-write Halloween 4. But overall, this is one of the few times.
And we'll just really quickly, the reason why he teamed up with Dennis Etchison is because Etchison had written the novelizations of Halloween 1 and 2.
Okay.
And so that's why Carpenter had teamed up with him.
Okay. And so you did have a little bit of the Carpenter flair as far as the writing in this. Some of the what's weird, though, being that it's from Carpenter, is I don't know if it was the acting or necessarily the writing itself, but, man, there were so many one-liners that will drive you nuts in this film. And then so that's where we got to here. Now, Daniel Harris.
Yes.
Plays a little girl in this. She also plays in Rob Zombie's Halloween.
Oh, yes.
Where you see her boobs.
Yeah, boobs.
And it's so weird watching last week Rob Zombie's Halloween and then seeing this little girl. And I don't know why. I was the only one that kind of looked at the little girl and went, I'm going to see your boobies again.
Yeah, I felt like, felt like my namesake, Captain Creeper, watching it. Because knowing that, you flash forward, 20 years or whatever, and I'm, picturing her naked. And so I'm just like, maybe I should see someone about this.
Yes. So overall, I as far as all the Halloweens go, I love Halloween 4. I think as far as my favorite Halloweens, behind 1, above 2 is Halloween 4.
Hmm. I didn't hate this movie. I felt it was, and I actually wrote it down, it felt like it really moved slow compared to, I guess 2 and even Rob Zombie's remakes.
Compared to Rob Zombie's remake, Rob Zombie's remakes are, like on speed.
Right. But I don't, maybe that's because, I'm watching this after we had watched the remakes or whatever, but I just felt like it was a really slow movie, moving movie. And, you were mentioning the fact that, no one really, except for Mustafa, was involved. Did they change the music?
They did change. Jeff, did they change the tempo of the music? Because it does have a little different. Did.
Yeah, they actually had a new composer come in, and he tried to stick with the same basic. I'm looking Alan Howarth. That's Howarth, something like that. Anyway, he had assisted John with Halloween 2 and 3 with the music for Halloween 2 and 3, and So when they went ahead and did this film, the director, Dwight H. Little, who directed Halloween 2, I believe, or maybe it's Halloween 5. I'm getting all confused now. But anyway, he did. The difference was is that he added his own little synthesizer twist. Plus, he also included new tracks.
Okay, that's what it is. So it's more layered.
Yeah.
Okay, because I knew there was difference to it, and I couldn't tell if it was like a faster tempo or what it was, but now that you mention it, I do recognize that there was more layers to it.
Yeah.
Yeah, I guess, and I couldn't have described it either. I just know that it wasn't the simplistic music that we had from the first one, at least.
Yeah, the first Halloween was basically plucked on a piano.
Yeah. Well, it was a keyboard, but yeah.
Yeah, well, I'm just saying. Piano, keyboard, there's, white things with black things. You push them with your fingers.
I think my biggest problem with Halloween 4 is that they were really trying to get super cerebral with it. I mean, that's, I think, was its biggest downfall. Because many of your complaints have a lot to do with the fact that they were expecting people to think a lot harder than we really are used to doing when we see Michael do stuff.
Well, you know what? They take that back in Halloween 5. Actually, more in Halloween 6 than 5. But I think with that, now is a good time. Wow, I had that up way too loud. To head over to Captain Creeper's Book Corner.
All right. Welcome to this week's Captain Creeper's Book Corner. This week we are discussing the 21st Century Dead, a zombie anthology. It's edited by Christopher Golden. He is an incredibly prolific author. Ironically, though, he doesn't have a story in the book. He just edited it. It's 352 pages long, and it was published July 17th of this year, 2012. The basic plot of this particular anthology is Stoker, award-winning editor of the New Dead series, returns with the 21st Century Dead, an all-new lineup of authors from all corners of the fiction world, shining a dark light in our fascination with tales of death and resurrection, with zombies. The Stellar Stories, this volume, include a tale set in the world of Daniel H. Wilson's Robo-Apocalypse, the first published fiction of Sons of Anarchy creator Kurt Sutter, a tale of love, family, and resurrection from the legendary Orson Scott Card. This new volume also includes stories from other award-winning New York Times bestselling authors such as Simon R. Green, Chelsea Kane, Jonathan Mayberry, and others.
I like here, that, and others.
Well, there is a story in here from Amber Benson.
Oh, from Buffy?
Yes. She, if you did not know, she is not only an actress, but she's a director, a producer, and an author. So my likes and dislikes, I've been reading these anthologies for years now, and the most recent ones that are supposed to be zombie collections are really kind of hit and miss. And this one's no exception. There are some great stories in here, and then there's some not so great ones. Some of the good stories are Kurt Sutter, again, creator of Sons of Anarchy, one of my favorite TV shows. And the title of the story is Tick Boom, A Slice of Love. Daniel Wilson's Parasite, which takes place in the world of his Robo-Apocalypse, as well as Jonathan Mayberry's Jack and Jill, which is set in the same world as his Dead of Night novel. The big problem with these is that many of these stories aren't even about zombies or have zombies in them. And this includes Daniel Wilson's, his story, Parasite. And again, it takes place in his Robo-Apocalypse world. They're not zombies unless you have broadly redefined what it means to be a zombie, even more so than what we've done here on the CreeperCast. What's great about these books is it's a chance to read works by authors you may not normally read, and may lead you to read more of their stuff. Of course, there's no guarantee that you'll like this stuff, but it's better than the alternative of buying a whole book and finding out you don't like it, a quarter of the way through, and then you're out the money. I also like that in this collection that not all of these stories have happy endings. Yeah, I know we're supposed to root for the good guy, for the heroes to live and survive the zombie apocalypse, but it's a nice change when it doesn't always happen. And did I mention not all of these stories have zombies?
Yeah.
Anyways, this is a decent read. I'm glad I got it from the library, though. I'm giving it a 3 out of 5. It's in paperback and ebooks and audiobooks. And that is this week's Captain Creeper's Book Corner.
All right.
And really quickly, before we move on, I wanted to throw out there, because you were mentioning zombie anthology stories, that a suggestion to you as well there, Mike, is look into an anthology called The Living Dead, in which you do have a lot of authors you've heard of before. And I actually just finally started reading it. I bought it a year ago. It's eek. I forgot his name. John Joseph Adams edited the anthology. It's basically got a whole bunch of people you've heard of and a whole bunch of others. Obviously, Stephen King, Harlan Ellison, Robert Silverberg, George R.R. Martin, Clive Barker, Neil Gaiman, Joe Hill, Lauren K. Hamilton, just to name a few. And actually, they do all have to do with zombies in all their very, in their various forms. I mean, you have voodoo zombies all the way up to the living dead. I'm actually only on the first story, and I'm already creeped out. It's about a teacher who's like holed herself up in a school, and she collects children, the children zombies that are walking by, and basically pulls out all their teeth and chains them to the floor, and then tries to teach them.
That sounds awesome.
It's actually a pretty creepy story.
And you said this was called The Living Dead? The Living Dead by John Joseph Adams?
Yes.
Okay, I may have read parts of this because it's either this anthology or there's another one called The New Dead. Excuse me, again, supposed to be zombie anthologies. And there was a story in there, and I can't remember who it's by. And this is the same problem that I had with this 21st Century Dead, is the only connection to zombies in this one particular story is this guy keeps thinking about zombies.
Oh.
And that's it. I mean, there's no living dead. It's just a guy fascinated with the zombie apocalypse.
See, what's great about this anthology, when you read the beginning of it, is that the guy even explains that, you know, he pretty much feels that everybody knows what zombies are by now. So he's not, so none of the stories actually spend time trying to explain how they came about or any of that. It's just, they just take you right into a zombie situation. It seems like a pretty good read so far. Like I said, I'm only one story in, but with the amount of, you know, the credits that are involved in the book.
I'll have to check it out from the library again and see if that's right. One I... And we'll do a review.
Yeah, we could do a review together. That would be weird, wouldn't it? So what do we have in horror television, Jason?
All right. Well, this week coming up in horror television, I told you last week that I was going to talk about 666 Park Avenue because Jeff refuses to actually do the podcast that he said he was going to do.
Because Jeff works constantly.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Slacker.
Mind you, I am not doing my Revolution podcast because that TV show really does kind of suck.
I actually gave up. I after about the third episode, I started to, because I missed it when it was on, because it's actually on the same time as Castle, so it automatically loses in that particular time slot.
You know, and that's the thing. I'm going to go off on a tangent right now. I really wanted it to be good and great because of the people behind it. But as much as I try, I cannot get into it. It's like, I don't know if it moves too slow or if I just don't care anymore or, you know.
That's where I'm at. You know, I started to stream it the other night and, you know, I was just like, you know what? I just don't care.
Yeah, yeah. So as far as apocalyptic movie TV shows go, yes, this is definitely not it.
Love's Dragon seems to like it. I've only watched the first episode, and I was happy with the last 10 minutes. It had a lot of action.
Yeah, well, that's about all it is basically people walking around and action, and then people walking around in action. All right, but
I like the guy who plays the uncle, though.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
I like him, but, you know, the rest of the cast or whatever, you know, I'm like, you know what? All we need now is zombies or robots or to eat these people because I just don't care if they ever die.
So about 666.
So about 666. Mind you, I want to let you know that we do record this podcast on Sundays now, and so we record it before the latest episode actually airs when you hear this. So I'm going to actually go back to the first two episodes since the third episode is tonight, and 666 is a really good show. The plot basically can be summed up like this. A couple, Jane and Henry, from the Midwest, come to New York in the hopes of landing the yuppie American dream. In their pursuit, they land a job managing the historic Drake Building by its wealthy owners, Gavin and Olivia Doran. And that's where the seduction of the Drake begins. We're thrust into the swanky rich lifestyle the building brings, and basically all the pitfalls that come along with it. Thanks mostly to the owner, Gavin, who's played by Terry O'Quinn. If you want to know Gavin, basically just think of Damien all grown up with a shaved head. We also discover that the Drake has a very sated past, but we don't yet know exactly how bad it really was. There's murder, cults, and devil worshipping that took place in this plaza that we do know. In the second episode, called Murmurations, Jane makes a terrifying discovery about what lies behind the walls of the Drake. As she begins to renovate an apartment, Henry wrestles with whether he should or should not tip Gavin off to some inside info he has on one of Gavin's big projects. And Gavin, Drake resident Daniel Vincent, gets a little help with love, thanks to the devil. That's what I'm gonna start calling him Devil rather than Gavin, because that's really what he is. During the renovation, Jane finds a large flock of birds living in the original air shafts, And according to the exterminator, it's the largest murmuration, which I guess means birds living together.
What it means is it's like a flock of geese or a murder of crows. It's a murmuration of that particular bird.
Ah, okay.
See, I watch the show and I pay attention.
I watch the show too. I have a baby around me though. That screams a lot. Jane's told by the Drake resident thief, Nora Clark, not to disturb the birds. They're part of the Drake, she says. As it turns out, the air shaft somehow ends at the mysterious door that we learned about in the pilot episode that was bricked over. Then things get Hitchcockian with the birds. I'll just let you figure that part out. Jane is also drawn deeper into the Drake's history, which probably won't end well for her and Henry. Overall, 666 Park Avenue is a fun, suspenseful, albeit very soap opera-like show. The main draw to the show, in my opinion, is Terry O'Quinn and the mysteries of the Drake, but mostly Terry O'Quinn. The rest of the cast, including our main characters, Jane and Henry, played by Rachel Taylor and Dave Annabelle, respectively, don't really seem to have much depth. I don't really care about them, so I'll only be watching it for O'Quinn and the Drake.
Okay.
Over at the CW, Supernatural Sam and Dean are trying to get the tablet that banishes all demons and closes the gates to hell back, with the help of Kevin's mom. We learn that Kevin stashed the tablet in a public locker in Laramie, Wyoming, at a bus depot, but it was stolen, and then pawned, and then bought by some supernatural auction house to be sold alongside Thor's hammer. They're invited to the auction, which was actually a trap for Kevin, and it intended on having Kevin memorize the tablet while it was on display. But it was covered, so he couldn't. Then they try to buy it, but they can't because, evidently, supernatural auctions don't deal with regular currency. So they try to steal it, which also didn't turn out too well. Crowley ends up turning up and tries to kidnap Kevin by possessing his mother. Dean almost kills her, and then she sells her soul. Yeah. The episode revealed what happened to Cass. He was left in purgatory, or he left Dean in purgatory to protect Dean. He didn't actually go back to heaven like we thought. He spent most of the year on the run from the Leviathan, while also sporting a pretty cool beard. The highlights of the episode was Sam and Dean going from Plan A to Plan B, and then C and D, maybe E. And Sam taking out some bad guys with Thor's hammer.
That was pretty sweet.
As of this recording, tonight is Season 3 premiere of The Walking Dead.
Yes.
So I won't really say anything about it, because if you want to know, you can hear our reactions by listening to our Walking Dead Week in Review from your favorite podcasting software, i.e. iTunes, or at our website at creepercast.com/TWD. And that's what happened this week in Horror TV.
Real quickly, I want to mention the 666 Park Avenue. I will be reviewing the book that it's based off sometime in the near future.
Really? I didn't know that it was based off a book.
I didn't know it was either until he told me.
Yeah, I think I Googled it or something. I was looking it up online and I went, oh, there's actually several books.
Don't forget, like I said, right after The Walking Dead airs tonight, me and Jeff, along with a very special guest, and by special, she's been on before, and she's a great fan and a great cast member. We are going to be talking about our reactions to The Walking Dead season premiere, and that's how we're going to run the first half of the season, which is basically a reactions episode, and then we'll go a little bit more in-depth during their hiatus.
Yes.
All right, Jeff, are you ready for some news?
Sure, I got a little bit of news. In the news this week, in release this week, Paranormal Activity 4
comes out this weekend, as per when people get to hear this episode. I don't know about anybody else, but I'm not real super excited about this one.
Neither am I.
It's directed by Ariel Schulman and Henry Joost, who also directed Paranormal Activity 3, and it's written by Zach Estrin. It's Paranormal Activity 4. The plot takes place 5 years after Paranormal Activity 2. So let me see if I can figure this out. So we have Paranormal Activity, and then we have the prequel to that, which is known as Paranormal Activity 2. Paranormal Activity 3, I have no idea where it goes, but apparently Paranormal Activity 4 goes after Paranormal Activity 2. Is everybody following me very well?
I have a headache.
Not a clue.
Yeah, exactly. Anyway, so apparently Paranormal Activity 2, which ended with Katie kidnapping Hunter, it follows the life of Alice and her boyfriend Alex, her mother, and her brother Wyatt as Paranormal Activity starts to occur in their home. No, really? And Katie and Hunter, now called Robbie, move into the neighborhood. A laptop is one of the techniques in the film, as well as the Kinect, as seen from the trailers. Now, what I think is interesting is that they're pushing this idea that a laptop is one of the techniques because they're using chat windows. Well, if you pay attention to the CreeperCast website, you'll see that I actually posted a review about the film VHS, which is an anthology series of found footage films. And in it, one of the stories was actually shot using chat windows. Basically, like, you know, the video chat windows. Which I actually like that one. It was probably my favorite out of the five that were in the film. So I'm not feeling as if this is a new technique if they've already done it in VHS. But it's I did like the way they used it in VHS, so who knows? Maybe it'll be all right in Paranormal Activity 4 or 2.3 or whatever. Once again, it comes out this weekend. For anybody for you people that really love the Paranormal Activity movies, from what I understand, the critics are saying you're going to love this one too. I don't happen to be one of those people.
Neither am I.
I actually have not seen any in the series. I saw, I think it was the end of part 2, because Jen watched it. Whatever one where they've got the pool out back, and at the very last scene is some girl snaps the dude's neck.
Yeah.
Whatever one that was, I was just like, I'm bored.
I don't remember, because that's how much I'm starting to care.
Yeah, exactly.
I have a little bit of TV news, because this was brought up, you know, Mike brought this up last week, and I wanted to make sure that it got, you know, brought up again. Is Mockingbird Lane. Yes, that's right. Not only has NBC definitely, is it going to happen on NBC, which is the Munsters reboot, by the way. They are actually airing the pilot on Friday, October 26th. And you can decide for yourself whether it's worth watching. I think Mike actually even brought up the fact that that Tim Curry was supposed to be playing Grandpa. Oh, yeah, you're right. Eddie Izzard. That's right. Okay, I confuse my British guys sometimes. Eddie Izzard, exactly. And then you have Jerry O'Connell coming in as Herman. There is a trailer out there for it that I will link to a teaser preview that I will link to the website. That I do believe it kind of looks like it's supposed to be a prequel to the original series. Huh. Because of the way they're treating it. Because basically in the teaser, Grandpa builds Herman. So it kind of looks like it actually kind of looks fun. I'm hoping it's going to be as fun as it looks in the trailer. Honestly, I think that's all I have for the news this week. I didn't do a whole lot of work because I had a lot of other news to do.
That sounds excellent. All right, so let's head over to Halloween 5. I want to start this off by saying that the success of Halloween 4 that had jump-started the Michael Myers fame in the late 80s, or re-jump-started it again, basically gave birth to Halloween 5 right away. As Mustafa Akkad said about Halloween 5, again, drunk off the success of Halloween 4, we began production on Halloween 5. See, I made that up, right? Didn't I?
Yeah.
Huh? Yeah.
Yeah.
Here's the trailer.
Sounds good.
Sheriff? They want you down at the cemetery.
Today in the cemetery, somebody dug up a coffin. for the coffin of a 9-year-old girl. You've come back to us, my friend.
When are they going to realize that she is not him? She's just a child.
They know that Michael Myers is her uncle and that she attacks her stepmother. That's why they fear her, especially on Halloween. You're afraid. You're afraid the whole thing might start to happen again.
How many people did he kill last year? Have you forgotten?
But you never looked into his face, did you? You never saw his eyes. You never saw that nothing. No expression. Blank. My memory goes back 12 years. I prayed that he would burn in hell. But in my heart, I knew that hell would not have him. Michael Myers is outside.
The National Guard will take him to a maximum security facility, where he'll stay till the day he dies.
Never die.
Okay, so obviously that wasn't an official trailer because the only official trailer I could find on YouTube was German. So that was the best one that I could find. Halloween 5 actually takes place 1 year after Halloween 4, after Michael was shot down the mine and blown up. He didn't actually blow up. He drifted off into a river where he was saved by some weird hobbit living in the woods.
I think you mean hermit.
Or a hobbit.
Okay.
But yes, a hermit or Kermit. Was it Kermit or Hobbit? Anyway, on Halloween, he gets this weird psychic connection and wakes up after being in a coma. He likes being in comas. He sleeps a lot.
He's refreshed for his next killing spree.
That's where he gets all his power from. He just sleeps all the time. If we all slept for like a year at a time, we'd wake up with superpowers, I think. Anyway, so he gets up and kills the Hobbit, or Kermit, and goes back to Haddonfield to kill and stalk, or stalk and kill his sister, of which she is now mute. Did I miss anything?
You mean his niece?
Or his niece.
The only thing I think you missed is why am I even surprised that he can walk away from this stuff at this point?
One thing I have to say as far as plausible ways of surviving stuff, this is probably the best as far as plausibility.
You mean even after he takes 800 rounds to the chest?
Well, and was nursed back to health by a hobbit.
Okay.
They have special powers.
Most like Frankenstein.
And I guess the thing with this movie is now Loomis has... I think he's just gone over the edge at this point.
Loomis, it's like Dr. Loomis changes in every single iteration of the Halloween films. And in this one... In some cases, yeah, exactly. And but he's like, he comes off at first more soft spoken than he ever was, but then the stuff that he pulls, you just you don't get it.
I mean, I guess to an extent, I get where he's coming from, as far as you know, he's tired of dealing with Michael. And he knows that Jamie has this psychic connection with him, which is more fully explored in this movie than it was the last. But, you know, so I get that he, you know, wants to use her to try and get to Michael or whatever. But, you know, at some point you stop being, you know, the doctor trying to prevent, you know, murders, and you become a guy who's bullying a 9-year-old child.
Right. That's exactly it. And that's actually where I think a lot of this movie, you know, the theme of this movie is, you know, what, who's the person that's really the ultimate bad guy, the guy that's going around killing people, but, or, to get to his niece and basically take her away, or the guy that is basically toying with a 9-year-old girl in the hopes of getting his, I guess, for lack of a better term, white whale.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Well, and this is the first time that it's also that he mentioned in this movie. Again, we're getting more previews of this. What we find out in the following movie, you know, this cult of Thorn, the connection to Samhain, the psychic connection in this movie.
We just kind of touch on that, though.
Right. But we see the man in black who, right. You know, he's got this symbol. And again, we get more of that in the next film. But in this film, for the first time ever, Loomis actually kind of puts a name to what drives Michael. You know, in that soliloquy or whatever, where he's actually speaking to Michael and he talks about the rage,
yes.
The all-consuming rage that drives him. And, you know, putting it in perspective of if you look at this movie and go back and look at the other three, you're like, okay, I can see that, you know, where he's coming from. And that's one of the things I guess I liked about this movie is the fact that he put a name to it. You know, it's like, you know, he's not just killing for the sheer joy of killing or just because it happens to be happenstance and, you know, it's his knees. He's driven by this, you know, this all-consuming rage.
Right, that's it. You know, and this is one of the first times I don't remember him in this movie using the evil line.
That's true.
Yeah, you know that you say.
You know, you have the first one. He talks about evil multiple times. Second one talks about it a couple times. Fourth one, it's like every other word out of his mouth. This one, he doesn't use it at all.
Now that you say that, you're absolutely. Maybe he finally, you know, maybe Donald Pleasance finally, you know, did what I did and said, okay, they got it, guys. He's evil. We get that. We don't need to say it every other line.
Now, I got a question with this one, though. Bullets don't kill Michael. Falling off a house doesn't kill Michael. Falling down a mineshaft and being blown up doesn't kill Michael. Being beat in the head doesn't kill Michael. But tranquilizers can weaken him?
Yeah, he gets, you know, like I said, you know, he walks away from 800 rounds to the chest, you know, buckshot, point blank, you know, like you said, falls down a mineshaft that gets blown up, and yet he's completely affected by tranquilizer darts, just like you and I.
Yeah,
well, I think it just proves that he totally gets off on pain.
That might be it. That very well might be it.
But you give him something like a tranquilizer, and he doesn't know what to do.
I love taking tranquilizers. they help me through the night.
Now, what I think is one of the things that I wanted to tie in with this is that you'll notice that this is also the film, though, that this one almost got an X rating because of violence.
Yeah, it did. And not only violence against people, but animals. It's one of the Halloween is one of the few movies that you will actually see Michael and for some reason hates dogs.
Oh, man, does he hate dogs. It's like he kills one in every freaking movie.
Well, he killed one in the second one and he killed one in this one.
Well, and what's interesting about the addition of violence, though, with this film, especially following Halloween 4, is that because of Danielle Harris, they had actually cut back on a lot of the violence because, you know, Mustafa was afraid of, you know, psychologically traumatizing her.
Yeah, that worked out.
Yeah, whereas but then later, because they figured there wasn't enough violence, they actually did some pickup shots where they, like, you know, like the eye gouging scene and and all that in 4 were pickup shots they did later because they didn't feel like they had enough violence. Well, in this one, they just ramped it up.
Speaking of 4, I want to jump back because we should have talked about this in the last segment. Remember the first kill of Halloween 4? He shoves his freaking thumb through a guy's skull.
Yeah. Yeah.
Now, I've seen Jason Voorhees do some pretty crazy things, smashing guys' face and, you know, and stuff like that. But to stick your thumb through somebody's frontal lobe, I have to say Michael Myers definitely gets the cred for being the top slasher. He would kick Jason's ass because he stuck his thumb through a skull.
After being in a coma for 10 years when all of his muscles should have been completely atrophied.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. So say what you want about who's going to win between Michael Myers and Jason, it'll be Michael. He stuck his thumb through a guy's skull.
Back to the violence, though, and then back to when, and I'll save the other part that ties into Rob Zombie when we get to the end of our end discussion of the film. But that the violence is Rob Zombie actually modeled a greater portion of his violence in Halloween 2 after this film, because he wanted to, you know, he wanted to go all out with it. So I do think it's interesting that, again, we talked about how old was Danielle Harrison for?
In 4, I don't know how old the actress was. She was playing a 9-year-old or an 8-year-old in 4, 9-year-old in 5.
Okay, well, I do think it's funny that a year later they decide to, you know, that they decide, oh, well, we're not worried about her getting twisted by the violence. And actually, she became really good friends with Don Shanks, who was playing Michael in
The Shape.
In 5.
He's not Michael, he's the shape.
I'm sorry.
Yes, make sure you say that right.
That is kind of funny when you consider all the violence, and yet her and Don Shanks actually got to be really close friends.
No, I don't doubt that at all, because, you know, the thing is when they talk about violence on set, violence on screen and violence on set are two completely different things. What looks violent on screen, on set almost looks funny. And you can ask anybody that works in horror films, and we've had quite a few people on that have said that.
Bill Oberst has actually even said that, yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, and so, yeah, to say that, you know, you would twist a girl, you know, because of violence on in a movie, I doubt it, because to her, you know, it's a good friend, they're acting, you know, whatever. But, okay, now let's talk about the prison break at the end.
Okay.
Because to me, this whole film is just a lead up to the prison break, which is a lead up to 6. It's like, it's like 5 is simply just a vehicle to get to 6. And that's the whole way that I saw it. And you have, you know, right at the end, after they tranquilize Michael, they take him and they put him in jail. And we find out that's when we get the Man in Black, and we get, you know, the breakout of jail and everything. And Michael kidnaps his niece, and they end up disappearing until the next one when she has his baby. We'll talk about that next week or in 2 weeks. But
you might talk about it next week. I don't know.
Yeah,
you are
going to
be talking about the expert. You're going to be talking to a Halloween expert. So.
You know, that was one thing, you know, when you get to the end and you realize, you know, what happened at the end, that's when you almost feel cheated for the rest of the movie, in my opinion, because they put you on this great roller coaster ride, but then you realize, wait a minute, it was all just a vehicle to get to the next movie.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, and I feel the same way about this movie as I did 4. It really kind of moved slow for me.
Really? I didn't think 5 moved slow at all.
Maybe it's because I've seen the movie so many times and I knew what was happening. I just didn't really... It really didn't do much for me. And it's because I know that I wanted to see more of, you know, the Man in Black and that whole thing. And even the, you know, you're talking about the jailbreak scene. That must have been the fastest jailbreak killing spree on record.
Oh, he just slaughtered everyone.
I mean, he walks in. Well, yeah, but he, you know, the one cop runs in and she gets out of the car almost immediately after. And yet by the time she makes, even though she's walking a little bit slow, by the time she gets to where Michael was, you know, to the cell, not only is everybody dead and not moving, but Michael is gone. You know, he's out of the cage, and so is the Man in Black. And you're just like, man, did he just sprint through there?
Yes. All right. I think with that, though, we need to wrap this up because we're running out of time. In fact, we're already over time. So,
All right. Then I'm going to quickly with the, I mean, this is an ending that we talked about before with Rob Zombie that a lot of people, at least Donald Pleasance and even Danielle Harris, felt that that the movie was going to end with her being the killer.
Yeah, yeah. And you almost think that number six was going to start actually.
Yeah. And Donald Pleasance had, like, you know, tons of disagreements with Akkad and Akkad, however you say his name, citing that Jamie should have been portrayed as all evil after stabbing her stepmother. And then, so there would have been a chance to say something about all evil, you know, about evil anyway. And that Danielle Harris herself thought that by the end of it, she was going to end up being a killer. So. Which Rob Zombie actually did put in his alternate ending for Halloween 2. So, it only obviously it was Laurie instead of...
Jamie, right.
Jamie, but...
Okay, well, I think with that, let's get out of here.
All right.
All right, that was our podcast for Halloween 4 and 5. If you want to get a hold of us, give us a call, 503-454-6941. Send us an email at feedback@creepercast.com. Jeff, what do you got coming up next week?
What do I got coming up next week? Well, I don't have a whole lot coming up next week because you and Mike are going to be heading an interview with the expert of all things Halloween who's putting out the Halloween anthology soon, Justin Beam.
I am so going to pimp for a free copy of that book, I tell you what.
I know. And then 2 weeks, it'll be six.
It'll be the last.
And seven and eight.
The last of the Halloween movies.
All right. See you guys.
See ya.
See ya.